Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are very pleased to have with us today Professor Maurice Samuels. Professor Samuels received his BA, Master's, and PhD from Harvard University and currently serves as the Betty Jane Aniline Professor of French and Chair at Yale University. Professor Samuels served as chair of Yale's Judaic Studies program and has directed the Yale Program for the Study of Antisemitism since 2011. Professor Samuels further specializes in the literature and culture of 19th century France and was a recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship and the New York Public Library Coleman Center Fellowship. Professor Samuels is the author and editor of numerous works, including The Spectacular Past, Popular History, and the Novel in 19th Century France, Inventing the Israelite, Jewish Fiction in 19th Century France, The Right to Difference, French Universalism and the Jews, The Betrayal of the Duchess, and 19th Century Jewish Literature Reader. And today we will be discussing the fascinating topic of Professor Samuel's more recently published biography of Alfred Dreyfus and the Dreyfus Affair. Professor Samuels, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much.
Sure. Thank you, Ari. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. To get started, by way of background, putting things in context, the state of French society and politics at the time of the Dreyfus Affair, when do these events happen? What are we looking at in terms of French society, Jewish society in France at the time?
Sure. So the affair really started, the case started in late 1894. And it's important to keep in mind that at that point, France was over 100 years past the big French Revolution, which happened in 1789, through the 1790s. And modernity was well underway at that point. And by that, I mean both political modernity, so the kind of, halting shift towards more democracy. By after 1870, France was a republic. This was the Third Republic in France, and also that capitalism was underway. So the other revolution, the Industrial Revolution, had taken place that caused all kinds of changes in the French economy, but also in French society. And there were rifts in the social fabric as a result. A lot of people welcomed these changes, the political and economic modernity, and other people felt resentful towards them. So that, I would say, is part of the undercurrent of what is going on during the affair. A couple of other factors. France lost a big war to Prussia in 1870, and Germany unified right after that. And as a result of that war, France had to give newly unified Germany its two eastern provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. And that's where a lot of the heavy industry was. It also was where a lot of Jews lived, including Dreyfus's family originally. And as a result, French society felt like they had had a limb amputated. They felt like, the Franco-Prussian War in 1870 had to give up its two eastern provinces of Alsace and Lorraine to Germany. And as a result, there was a kind of cult of revenge in France, where French people wanted to regain those lost territories. And that also was fueling a kind of militaristic cult and a kind of worship of the army that also, I think, is important for the affair. You also asked about the situation of Jews. It's important to note that France was the first European country to grant Jews full civil rights. And that happened very early in France in 1790 and 91. So during the French Revolution, French Jews became full equal citizens. As a point of comparison, that didn't really happen in most of Germany until unification in 1870. Even in England, Jews couldn't sit in parliament, for example, until 1858. In France, they had full equal rights. And by the 1890s, the French Jews were the best integrated Jews in the world. So a lot of people say, like, why did the Dreyfus Affair happen in France? Was it because of French anti-Semitism? Yes, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But it was also because a Jew like Dreyfus could have attained, such a high position in the army, and that would have been very unlikely in most other countries.
And who was Alfred Dreyfus? Who was the man before we get to the affair? Where did he come from? What was his personality like? Where did he serve in the army?
Yeah, so he was a captain in the French army, so he was a French officer. His family came from Alsace, so from that eastern province where a lot of the Jews in France lived. His father had started out as a cloth peddler in the town of Mulhouse, in Alsace, but had gotten very wealthy. He actually took advantage of disruption in the cotton trade caused by the American Civil War in the 1860s and started his own textile manufacturing, his own, factories in Mulhouse. And so by the time that Dreyfus was growing up in the late 1860s, 1870s, the family was very wealthy. They lived in a mansion in the center of town. After 1870, when Germany took over Alsace, the Dreyfus family opted for French citizenship. They had a choice, although Alfred Dreyfus's oldest brother, Jacques, took German citizenship in order to hold on to the factories in Mulhouse. So Alfred Dreyfus was sent to boarding school in France and in Paris and decided to pursue a career in the military. He was an ardent French patriot. He was kind of traumatized, I would say, by the loss of Alsace, his home province, to Germany in 1870. And so he decided to devote his life to the army. He was married to a Jewish woman named Lucy Adamar. They were nominally Orthodox. Dreyfus himself was not personally religious. He was, a rationalist and a scientist. But his wife was pretty religious. And in the book, which is really focused on the Jewish aspect of the case, I spend a lot of time talking about what Jewishness meant for the Dreyfus family. A lot of previous historians have said that they were an assimilated Jewish family. And I object to that label because to me, assimilation implies that you've given up your Jewishness in order to join the dominant culture. And that was really not at all true for the Dreyfus family. They were, lived in a very Jewish milieu. All of Dreyfus's siblings married other Jews. Both of his children married other Jews. He himself was married in the Grand Synagogue of Paris by the chief rabbi of France, who was a close family friend. So, to me, they were by no means assimilated in that sense that they had given up, they had renounced their Jewish identity. But I do say they were very well integrated into French society. And for the Dreyfuses, that meant, and for a lot of French Jews of their class, the kind of upper middle and upper classes, that meant that they were discrete Jews. They were, outwardly very similar to other French people of their class, and they felt like their Jewish faith was a matter of, that was something that they did in private. But I did, I for the book, I researched, the big collection of Dreyfus materials that the Dreyfus family left to the Jewish Museum in France. And it contained a lot of Jewish ritual objects, including his wife Lucy's Hebrew prayer book. You know, so these were, you know, they were Jewish. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. So then actually about his personality, he was a shy guy. He was not very comfortable in public. He was, as I said, a kind of rationalist, a kind of technocrat in the army. He was a specialist in munitions. He didn't enjoy his, a lot of his friend, the, his colleagues in the army resented him. And I think that plays into what happened later. They partly resented him, I think, because he was Jewish for some people. A lot of people also resented the fact that he was from this wealthy family. So he had a large private income that enabled him to live, you know, really very, very well at a time when so his income was 40,000 francs a year from his family at a time when other army officers of his rank made about 2,000 francs a year.
So as he goes into the army, people know that he's Jewish. I mean, that's just like people know this is not a Catholic French person. This is a Jewish French citizen. It's known.
Yeah, it would have been, you know, completely clear from his name. And, you know, with Dreyfus is like one of the most common Alsatian Jewish names. So it's like, you know, Jones for Alsatian Jews. And he didn't try to hide it, you know. And there was one, and when he was in officer training school, there was one incident where that I talk about in the book, where his superior officer, like the instructor for the class, gave him the top grade for technical accomplishment and a zero for character. And this guy, this teacher, was an avowed anti-Semite. And Dreyfus complained. He registered a formal complaint with the school, and he was told, well, it's not going to affect your final grade, you know, the way you'll graduate, you're standing in the class. So, you know, you should let it drop. And he did. But he was not someone who tried to hide his Jewish identity in any way.
And specific charges, what were the charges? When did they originate? What were they? Why was he accused of espionage and whatever else he was accused of?
Yeah, so that's a great story. So what happened was that the French counter-espionage service had a spy working in the German consulate, and she was the cleaning lady. She was an illiterate cleaning lady. So the German military attaché didn't think much about ripping up documents and throwing them in the trash because he thought she couldn't read them. She would collect the trash and bring it to the French counter-espionage service. So in the fall of 1894, she did that. And there was a ripped up document by a French military officer offering to sell military secrets to Germany. So they knew there was a spy in their midst. And they did a cursory investigation. They leapt to a few different assumptions, including that the person offering the spy was a had to be an intern on the general staff of the army, someone who moved to different divisions. And they looked at the list of interns on the general staff. There was one Jewish name, Alfred Dreyfus. They looked at his handwriting. It had a superficial similarity to the handwriting on the document. Although at this time, you know, everyone learned penmanship in school, so everyone's handwriting looked somewhat similar. And there were also big differences in the handwriting that they glossed over. In fact, one of the handwriting experts came up with this bizarre theory that Dreyfus must have forged his own handwriting on that letter. But they, you know, it's pretty clear. I weigh the evidence in the book, and I say it's pretty clear that anti-Semitism must have had a lot to do with it. So they summoned him to army headquarters, forced him to take dictation, where he had to write out some of the words that were in the letter. And without even really looking at it, they very theatrically announced, you are under arrest. And he had no idea what he was being arrested for.
Okay. Wouldn't it be in the interest of the French military to do a thorough investigation? Because there's a spy, and if they're not getting the right person, they got a real issue here of somebody continuing to spy for Germany. It sounds like it was a very superficial investigation.
It was very superficial, and they showed this secret file to the judges at Dreyfus's court-martial that contained documents that, it's beyond to say that they were circumstantial is really understating the case. The main document used to incriminate Dreyfus was a letter from the German military attaché referring to that scoundrel D, and they knew very well that that referred to someone else. So they clearly knew that their case against Dreyfus was flimsy, and they decided to kind of fake the evidence. And it really goes to show that, rather than just admit their mistake, I think I should say that they were under a lot of pressure. The Minister of War was under a lot of pressure to unmask the spy. And that was because he was seen as a modernizer in the army, and the far right, the nationalist right, didn't like him. So he thought, the Minister of War thought, that by unmasking this spy and how great that they suspected a Jew, if a Jew did it, all the better, he would come off looking really good. But unfortunately, there was not that much evidence, and instead of admitting that, they just kept going further and further down the track towards really what was a frame job of Dreyfus, and then, and I'm sure we'll get to this, a cover up to protect the actual spy when the identity of the actual spy came to light.
And so why doesn't this just remain a spy accusation, investigation, and end of story? I mean, you're just talking about a captain. It doesn't sound like it's a spy, but it doesn't sound like it's, such
Yeah,
a
indeed.
big to do. How does it
Right.
become, how does it rip French society? How does it become the Dreyfus affair?
Yeah, how does this legal case become an affair? That's one of the things I also try to think about in the book. And I say in the book that it became an affair because he was Jewish. So what I think is clear from the case is that the case became a test for liberal democracy at the time, which is to say two things. First of all, did the government decl give equal rights to all its citizens through the rule of law, regardless of national or military interests? So that was one of the key issues of the case, because people against Dreyfus were like, well, the army can't, it'll be bad for France if the army admits a mistake. And Dreyfus's defenders said that doesn't matter, that liberal democracy is based on the rule of law. And if we can't guarantee in all individuals the right to a fair trial, then liberal democracy means nothing. So that was one of the issues. But then the other issue has to do more with Jewishness. So this was a time when the Jewish question, as people called it at the time, was really coming to the fore, especially in Western democracies that were seeing a huge influx of immigrants, especially from Eastern Europe following the Russian pogroms in the 1880s. So, of course, millions of poor Orthodox Jewish immigrants were flooding into the United States, but in France also had a large immigration, a large influx. And this was really testing, like the same way that immigration is testing national identity now in Western democracies. Like, are we going to be a country that is universalist and open to everyone, regardless of religion or race? Or are we an ethnic democracy where we are a people? You know, like Germany kind of went more down that track. France saw itself in the 19th century as more like the United States, a universalist republic open to everyone. There wasn't an ethnic Frenchness that had any kind of political saliency, but some people on the right wanted to impose that. And that also was at issue in the case. So could a Jew like Dreyfus really be French? And could he be a French army officer? So at the very center of, you know, what of Frenchness in that sense, that was also at issue in the case. And there were right-wing journalists who I talk about in the book, especially this guy, Edouard Drumont, who published a daily anti-Semitic newspaper that relentlessly attacked the Jews in the place of Jews in French national life, accusing them of not really being French, of being potential traitors. And one of his prime targets was the presence of Jews in the military, which he thought was an abomination because these people were not really French, could never really be French, and therefore should not be in the army.
I mean, was there a large percentage of Jews in the army, or was it reflective of society, or was it a small percentage?
Well, in fact, Jews were overrepresented compared to their numbers. So it's important to realize that Jews were a tiny fraction of French society. So they were something like 0.2% of the French population in the 1890s, like around 80,000 out of 40 million French people. But in the army in the 1880s, 1890s, there were around 300 officers of Jewish background. So they were overrepresented there. They were also overrepresented in certain school, you know, very elite schools, including the École Polytechnique, which is where Dreyfus went, which was a kind of feeder for the Army Officer Corps. At the time that Dreyfus went there in the 1880s, Jews were like 3 to 4% of the school, and they were only 0.2% of French society. So, you know, you can see they were kind of overrepresented, and they were very visible because a lot of Jews lived in Paris, where they were more visible. They were a much higher percentage of the Parisian population, and they were very prominent in the arts, in business, in journalism, in these kind of high profile professions.
Emile Zola, and how did he change the trajectory of the entire Dreyfus affair?
Yeah, so Emile Zola was a very popular and prominent novelist. He was known for writing kind of scandalous novels around social issues. So he had a, you know, about like the, you know, labor strikes. He had, you know, a novel, a kind of anti-Semitic novel about the stock exchange that he published in 1892. So for a couple of years before the Dreyfus affair, it was clear that he had, you know, kind of mildly anti-Semitic views, like a lot of, you know, people did at the time. But he really believed in the French Republic. And he began to realize that anti-Semitism was a deep threat to the Republic, that, you know, these right-wing anti-Semites were using hatred of the Jews to galvanize disaffection and anger at the government and at the Republican form of government. So he began to be interested in the case. And then when he Dreyfus's family and other supporters went to him and showed not only that there was no evidence of Dreyfus's innocence, but that they knew who the real culprit was, who the real spy was, who was this kind of dissolute minor nobleman named Ferdinand Walsen Esterhazy, and that the army was covering up The evidence of Esterhazy's treachery in order to keep Dreyfus in prison, and we can talk about his life in prison. Zola became outraged. So he wrote this blockbuster article with the banner headline, J'accuse, I accuse, in a newspaper in 1898. It sold 300,000 copies and it really blew the lid off the case. After that point, that's really when the case became an affair. It was no longer possible to ignore that a huge injustice, excuse me, had been committed against Dreyfus. And when he wrote that article, the far right was so incensed that it set off months of anti-Semitic riots all across France and colonial Algeria. Something like 69 French cities had almost like pogroms in the spring of 1898.
And so Emile Zola continued his involvement. He was in touch with the family. He met Dreyfus at this point, was imprisoned after he was stripped of his rank, and Emile Zola was part visited him, and there was a relationship between them.
No. So Dreyfus, he was found guilty in late 1894 after this 3-day court martial, and then he had to undergo this humiliating public degradation ceremony in the courtyard of the École Militaire in Paris. So if you can picture, it's right in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower. He was forced to parade around the courtyard with all the divisions of the army lined up. 10,000 people outside the gates screaming, "Death to the traitor, death to Judas." He kept yelling, "I am innocent, long live France," as they took his sword and broke it in two and ripped the insignia, the kind of epaulets off his uniform. And then he was shipped off to Devil's Island off the coast of South America, which was this brutal prison colony. If you've ever seen the movie with Steve McQueen, Papillon, it takes place at another one of a part of this same prison complex. But Dreyfus was the only prisoner on Devil's Island. It was surrounded by shark-infested waters. It was impossible to escape from. He was watched day and night. But his guards never spoke to him for 5 years. He was forced to gather wood to cook the inedible food, and it was like burning tropical heat. And then at night, he was chained to his bed, so he couldn't even roll over as like these horrible insects crawled all over him and they shone a light on him day and night. It was unbelievably brutal conditions. It's impossible to understand how he survived this for 5 years. So Zola had never met him. Zola just did this, because he felt like it was the right thing to do.
And now you have parts of French society taking sides. You have the Catholic Church, was the Catholic Church involved? And then the international response, as he's now in Devil's Island, I assume the family is continuing to try to prove his innocence at that time.
Yeah, so the family were really heroic. So especially his wife and his brother Mathieu. At first, like they had no one, they were totally alone. Like nobody, could believe that the army would make a mistake like this. And so they, even most members of the Jewish community at first didn't, they were just like horrified that this had happened. They couldn't believe that it was a mistake. But gradually, they kept pushing and pushing, and evidence of his innocence came to light. The big break was when they discovered the identity of the real traitor. That was a big thing. And then, more and more evidence came to light, including the fact that the army had kept forging documents, to incriminate Dreyfus. And someone discovered that the guy who was doing it was a terrible forger. He was using two different colored graph paper. So that came to light. The forger then committed suicide in prison. And that really, at that point, it was really impossible to ignore What had happened. And at that point, they bring Dreyfus back for a second trial. At this point, we're in 1899. But yeah, you asked about the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, really, this was not their finest moment. So they, for the most part, supported the army. They opposed justice for Dreyfus, even when it was clear that he was innocent. And that really helped lead to really what was like a almost like a civil war in France at the height of the affair in 1898, 1899. So it's really a division between left and right in France, people who support the Republican government and kind of right-wing people who are monarchist and kind of fundamentalist Catholics. That's what the cleavage was. In the book, I say that it's also a split between people who favored those developments I talked about at the beginning associated with modernity. So the political and economic transformation that France underwent in the 19th century, by and large, people who supported that or who benefited from it were Dreyfusards, were for Dreyfus, and people who resented those changes were anti-Dreyfusards. It's pretty clear that anti-Semitism became a way of expressing your dissatisfaction with those social changes.
This expression, Dreyfusards, right, an anti,
Dreyfusards, yeah.
right, Dreyfusards, is that an expression that came about after this affair, or that's the expression that was
That was
used during the affair?
during the affair. Like people were, calling themselves, Dreyfusards and anti-Dreyfusards. Yeah.
And at that time, what did the anti-Semitism in terms of what you call almost pogroms or pogroms, did that continue, or was that just a limited period of
Well,
time?
that was the actual riots and
Right.
violence were. There was like 1 year. The French historian, the French Jewish historian Pierre Birnbaum has an excellent book about that year of riots. But it was pretty terrible. And the worst riots occurred in colonial Algeria, where the non-Jewish European population, was violently anti-Semitic, and some people were actually killed. Some Jews were actually killed in Algeria.
And so there's a retrial, the evidence comes out, and is there a formal acquittal and reinstatement
Well,
of
yeah.
Dreyfus?
So what happens is,
And how old is he by now? Like
he's
how?
only in his late 30s. So one
Okay.
day, he has no idea what's going on in France because his wife and brother are writing him letters, but they're heavily censored. So he doesn't know anything about this fight is going on back in France to free him. But one day, his jailer says, get ready, you're going back to France. Like you're having another trial. So at this point, Dreyfus, who had been praying for this moment and been trying to really just stay alive to see it, thought, okay, all my troubles are over. I'll get back to France. I'll be hailed as a hero. That was not the case. So he sails back to France in the summer of 1899. He has another court martial. This one, the first one was only 3 days. This one plays out over several weeks. In August and September 1899, it's huge international news. So it's taking place in Rennes, which is kind of in northwestern France. Journalists from all over the world descend on France. This is, covered on the front page of every newspaper. At this point, it's clear that he's innocent, but he doesn't actually make a very favorable impression at the trial. He's stick thin at this point. Even though he's only in his late 30s, his hair has gone completely white. His voice is hoarse from not having spoken for 5 years. And also, he just is constitutionally unable to put on a show. So he just answers the questions, but it's clear that, even though he's completely innocent, that this isn't going that well. And the judges wind up split, but they vote in favor of another conviction of him, which is just so outrageous. But this time they do it with extenuating circumstances, they say. So, anyway, it's clear to everyone that he's innocent. Other countries are totally outraged by this. They can't understand how France could do this again. And there was some talk of boycotting the 1900 World's Fair in Paris that France had a huge investment in. So at this point, the president of the French Republic says, like, I can't let this keep, you know, go on. So he offers Dreyfus a pardon. Dreyfus's supporters don't want him to accept it. They want to keep fighting until he can completely prove his innocence. But, you know, it's clear, you know, this poor guy cannot go back to Devil's Island. So he accepts the pardon on the condition that he can keep fighting to clear his name. He does. So he goes back to his family. He keeps, you know, hunting for more exculpatory evidence. More finally does emerge. And then they have another kind of appeals trial in 1906, and he's completely exonerated at that point.
But never rejoins the army, reinstated.
Yes, he does. So he's reinstated in the army, but this is actually
after the pardon. After the pardon.
After the pardon. No, after the exoneration, right. He's given the Legion of Honor, and he's restored in to the army. But this is a sore point. They don't give him the rank that he would have had if all these years had not gone by. And so he decides to resign from the army at that point in a kind of very dignified way. But then when World War I breaks out, he's already, you know, in late middle age at that point, but he rejoins the army during World War I and fights in World War I. His son fights in like every major battle, like Verdun, all of these, the Marne. So his son really had a very heroic war also.
So they certainly remain French patriots to the end.
Total French patriot. Yes. Yes. And then, you know, sadly, I talk about in the book that the family also experienced the Holocaust. So Dreyfus himself died in 1935, but his wife was still alive during World War II. She has to go into hiding. His daughter's family goes into hiding in France. His son's family escapes to America during the war. But Dreyfus's favorite granddaughter was a resistance fighter, was captured and deported as a Jew and killed at Auschwitz. So it's very moving. Actually, I went to the family tomb in Montparnasse Cemetery, and Dreyfus, it's in order of death, and Dreyfus is the top, and then the granddaughter is the second one, and it just says deported, died at Auschwitz at the age of 26.
Okay. And there's a journalist that witnesses this or is influenced by this by the name of Theodor Herzl. What's the story behind that, and how did that make such an impact on Herzl?
Yeah, so Herzl is a journalist for German language newspapers in Paris at the time. He covered Dreyfus's degradation, so he was present. Later, he would claim that he had the idea for Zionism, witnessing Dreyfus's degradation, thinking if something like this can happen to a Jew, even in enlightened France, then Jews weren't safe anywhere and needed a country of their own. It turns out other historians have shown that this is a little bit of an exaggeration. He actually had the idea for Zionism a little bit before that. But what's certainly true is that the Dreyfus Affair played a key role in the development of Zionism. So the first Zionist congresses were taking place in right at the height of the affair. And this is, you know, as I said, this is the major worldwide news, and it comes up at all of these Zionist congresses. You know, Herzl, but also Max Nordau, who was a leading early Zionist, was deeply critical of French Jews for not coming to Dreyfus's defense, which I think he exaggerated that. I talk about it in the book, that most of the early Dreyfusards were Jewish, in fact. So he was using, they were using the Dreyfus Affair to build support for the Zionist cause, saying that even in France, the country where Jews, had the most rights and were the most integrated, things were really bad for Jews there. They needed a country of their own.
In other words, Russia, we understand why there's pogroms in Russia. Russia's Russia. But France should mean different.
And in fact, there's a great short story by the Yiddish writer Sholem Aleichem called, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but Dreyfus in Kasrolevka. So he wrote this in 1902 in Yiddish, and it's about the inhabitants of a small fictional Ukrainian shtetl who are obsessed by the Dreyfus affair. But only one person in the town subscribes to a newspaper. So they start following that guy to the post office to get the news of the affair as soon as it comes out. And they can't believe when Dreyfus is found guilty a second time, they can't believe it because they too believe that in France, things would be different. It would be one thing in Ukraine, but, in the Russian Empire, but in France, this was happening. That was truly a shock.
And so why does the Dreyfus, and all the things that happened in Jewish history in the 19th century, let's say, take just the 19th century, why does it resonate today, the Dreyfus? Why is it like such a defining event in Jewish and maybe even in world history, European history?
Yeah, so, I think, as I said before, I think that this case really became a test case for liberal democracy. It really was, all of these, this was the time when more and more countries were experimenting with liberal democracy, with moving away from monarchy and towards, a republic. And this case really brought to the fore what that meant, which was individuals have rights. They can't be arbitrarily shipped off to Devil's Island or tortured. They have, legal rights. There is something like the rule of law. So this case became a kind of test case for that. As I said, it was also a test case for the place of minorities within these liberal democracies. So I think that, was part of it, but also it's just a really fascinating case. So, as a little boy, I remember reading about this case and becoming completely obsessed with it because, here was this like Jewish army officer and like Devil's Island seemed so exotic and, just dramatic, and there's so many twists and turns of the case. I didn't even really do it justice here. I mean, there's so many dramatic events. So I really hope people do buy the book and read it because I go into much more detail. But it was just a really, really gripping, exciting case of, kind of legal thriller, basically, that I think has just always captured people's imaginations. I should say that also everyone loves a story about a truly innocent man who was really a good guy. And, one of the things that I think makes my biography of him different from the vast literature on the affair is that I really try to focus on him as a character. And following partly in the footsteps of the great French Dreyfus historian, Vincent Duclair, who does this too, but his books haven't been translated, unfortunately, into English. But I really try to look at like what kept Dreyfus going. And, I show that he really understood what was at stake in the case and realized that it was his survival was essential because otherwise justice could never triumph. So it was really a very heroic role that he personally played. And I try to talk about that in the book. And so it's really also a story about good eventually triumphing over evil. And we don't have that many stories like that. So I think people really, are attracted to the case for that reason.
Just on a personal note, after publication of the Alfred Dreyfus work, what's next in your plans? Another great hero of world and Jewish history? Anything else that's
No, I've written now a few books about French Jews, and my new book is actually not going to be about Jews. It's or not directly. It's about how French writers reacted to the coup of 1851 that ushered in 20 years of authoritarian rule, the Second Empire, but also produced some of the great masterpieces of French literature. So I'm looking at what happens to writers after a coup in a situation of tyranny, how they reacted. So that's what I'm just starting now.
So great success in that. And we urge all our viewers and listeners to go online. Very easy to purchase Professor Samuel's work on Alfred Dreyfus, which is part of the Yale University Jewish Life series. It's a wonderful collection. They're not 500 pages. They're very readable. They're page turners, and they're fairly thin books, and again, urge all our listeners and viewers to go online and check out the book and hopefully purchase it. Professor Samuels, thank you so much for today. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.